This is the Internet Multicasting Service. Harper Audio presents the third section of The Snows of Kilimanjaro, written by Ernest Hemingway and read by actor Charlton Heston. In this story, Hemingway uses some of his own experiences as a war correspondent.
He remembered the good times with them all, and the quarrels. They always picked the finest places to have the quarrels. And why had they always quarreled when he was feeling best? He'd never written any of that because at first he never wanted to hurt anyone, and then it seemed as though there was enough to write without it. But he'd always thought that he would write it finally. There was so much to write. He'd seen the world change, not just the events, although he'd seen many of them and had watched the people. But he had seen the subtler change, and he could remember how the people were at different times. He'd been in it, and he'd watched it, and it was his duty to write of it. But now he never would. "How do you feel?" she said. She'd come out from the tent now after her bath. "All right. Could you eat now?" He saw Molo behind her with a folding table and the other boy with the dishes. "I want to write," he said. "You ought to take some broth to keep your strength up." "I'm going to die tonight," he said. "I don't need my strength up." "Don't be melodramatic, Harry, please," she said. "Why don't you use your nose? I'm rotted halfway up my thigh now. What the hell should I fool with broth for? Molo, bring whiskey soda." "Please take the broth," she said gently. "All right." The broth was too hot. He had to hold it in the cup until it cooled enough to take it, and then he just got it down without gagging. "You're a fine woman," he said. "Don't pay any attention to me." She looked at him with her well-known, well-loved face from spur and town and country, only a little the worse for drink, only a little the worse for bed. But town and country never showed those good breasts and those useful thighs and those lightly smaller back-caressing hands. And as he looked and saw her well-known, pleasant smile, he felt death come again. This time there was no rush. It was a puff, as of a wind that makes a candle flicker and the flame go tall. "They can bring my net out later and hang it from the tree and build the fire up. I'm not going in the tent tonight. It's not worth moving. It's a clear night. There won't be any rain." "So this was how you died, in whispers that you didn't hear. Well, there would be no more quarreling, he had promised that. The one experience that he'd never had, he was not going to spoil now. He probably would. You spoiled everything. But perhaps he wouldn't. You can't take dictation, can you?" "I never learned," she told him. "That's all right." There wasn't time, of course, although it seemed as though it telescoped so that you might put it all into one paragraph if you could get it right. There was a log house, chinked white with mortar, on a hill above the lake. There was a bell and a pole by the door to call the people into meals. Behind the house were fields, and behind the fields was the timber. A line of Lombardy poplars ran from the house to the dock. Other poplars ran along the point. A road went up to the hills along the edge of the timber, and along that road he picked blackberries. Then that log house was burned down, and all the guns that had been on Deerfoot racks above the open fireplace were burned. And afterwards their barrels with the lead melted in the magazines and the stocks burned away lay out in a heap of ashes that were used to make lye for the big iron soap kettles. And you asked Grandfather if you could have them to play with, and he said no. You see, they were his guns still, and he never bought any others, nor did he hunt anymore. The house was rebuilt in the same place, out of lumber now, and painted white. And from its porch you saw the poplars and the lake beyond, but there were never any more guns. The barrels of the guns that had hung in the deer feed in the wall of the log house lay out there in the heap of ashes, and no one ever touched them. In the Black Forest, after the war, we rented a trout stream, and there were two ways to walk to it. One was down the valley from Triberg and around the valley road in the shade of the trees that bordered the white road, and then up a side road that went up through the hills past many small farms with the big Schwarzwald houses until that road crossed the stream. That was where our fishing began. The other way was to climb steeply up to the edge of the woods and then go across the top of the hills through the pine woods, and then out to the edge of a meadow and down across this meadow to the bridge. There were birches along the stream, and it was not big, but narrow, clear, and fast, with pools where it had cut under the roots of the birches. At the hotel in Triberg, the proprietor had a fine season. It was very pleasant. They were all great friends. The next year came the inflation, and the money he'd made the year before was not enough to buy supplies to open the hotel. And he hanged himself. You could dictate that, but you couldn't dictate the Place Contrescarpe, where the flower sellers dyed their flowers in the street, and the dye ran over the paving where the autobus started, and the old men and the women always drunk on wine and bad mark, and the children with their noses running in the cold, the smell of dirty sweat and poverty and drunkenness at the Café des Amateurs and the whores at the Bal Musette they lived above. The concierge, who entertained the trooper of the Garde Républicaine in her loge, his horsehair-plumed helmet on a chair. The locataire across the hall, whose husband was a bicycle racer, and her joy that morning at the Crémerie, when she'd opened Lotto and seen where he placed third in the Paris Tour, his first big race. She'd blushed and laughed and then gone upstairs crying with a yellow sporting page in her hand. The husband of the woman who ran the Bal Musette drove a taxi, and when he, Harry, had to take an early plane, the husband knocked on the door to wake him, and they each drank a glass of white wine at the zinc of the bar before they started. He knew his neighbors in that quarter then because they all were poor. Around that place, there were two kinds, the drunkards and the sportifs. The drunkards killed their poverty that way. The sportifs took it out in exercise. They were the descendants of the communards, and it was no struggle for them to know their politics. They knew who had shot their fathers, their relatives, their brothers, and their friends when the Versailles troops came in and took the town after the commune and executed anyone they could catch with calloused hands or who wore a cap or carried any other sign he was a working man. And in that poverty and in that quarter, across the street from a boucherie chevalin and a wine cooperative, he had written the start of all he was to do. There never was another part of Paris that he loved like that. The sprawling trees, the old white-plastered houses painted brown below, the long green of the autobus and that round square, the purple flower dye on the paving, sudden drop down the hill of the Rue Cardinal Lemoine to the river, and the other way, the narrow, crowded world of the Rue Mouffetard. The street that ran up toward the Pantheon and the other that he always took with a bicycle, the only asphalted street in all that quarter, smooth under the tires, with the high, narrow houses and the cheap, tall hotel where Paul Verlaine had died. There were only two rooms in the apartments where they lived, and he had a room in the top floor of that hotel that cost him 60 francs a month where he did his writing. And from it he could see the roofs and chimney pots and all the hills of Paris. From the apartments you could only see the wooden coal man's place. He sold wine, too. Bad wine. The golden horse's head outside the Boucherie Chevalin, where the carcasses hung yellow, gold, and red in the open window. And the green-painted cooperative where they bought their wine. Good wine, and cheap. The rest was plaster walls and the windows of the neighbors. The neighbors who at night, when someone lay drunk in the street, moaning and groaning in that typical French ivresse that you were propaganded to believe did not exist, would open their windows and then the murmur of talk. Where is the policeman? When you don't want him, the bugger's always there. He's sleeping with some concierge. Get the agent. Till someone threw a bucket of water from a window and the moaning stopped. What's that? Water. Ah, that's intelligent. And the windows shutting. Marie, his femme de ménage, protesting against the eight-hour day, saying, if a husband works until six, he gets only a little drunk on the way home. Does not waste too much. If he works only until five, he is drunk every night, and one has no money. It is the wife of the working man who suffers from this shortening of hours. Wouldn't you like some more broth? The woman asked him now. No, thank you very much. It's awfully good. Try just a little. I would like a whiskey soda. It's not good for you. No, it's bad for me. Cole Porter wrote the words and the music, this knowledge that you're going mad for me. You know I like you to drink. Oh, yes, only it's bad for me. When she goes, he thought, I'll have all I want. Not all I want, but all there is. He was tired. Too tired. He was going to sleep a little while. He lay still, and death was not there. It must have gone around another street. It went in pairs on bicycles and moved absolutely silently on the pavements. No, he'd never written about Paris. Not the Paris that he cared about. But what about the rest that he'd never written? What about the ranch? and the silver gray of the sagebrush, the quick, clear water in the irrigation ditches, and the heavy green of the alfalfa. The trail went up into the hills, and the cattle in the summer were shy as deer. The bawling and the steady noise and slow-moving mass raising a dust as you brought them down in the fall. And behind the mountains, the clear sharpness of the peak in the evening light, and riding down along the trail in the moonlight, bright across the valley. Now he remembered coming down through the timber in the dark, holding the horse's tail when you couldn't see, and all the stories that he meant to write.
This has been Harper Audio. HarperCollins is the copyright owner of this recording and has consented to a limited distribution of Harper Audio as an 8 kHz computer sound file on Internet Town Hall. It is a violation of United States and international copyright laws to copy these recordings in any other way. Harper Audio is a trademark of HarperCollins Publishers, Inc. To order a copy of this tape or to request a catalog of all Harper Audio spoken word cassettes, please call 1-800-C-HARPER or 717-941-1214 or send mail to harper@town.hall.org. This has been a production of the Internet Multicasting Service. Support for Harper Audio is provided by HarperCollins and by Sun Microsystems and O'Reilly & Associates. Network connectivity for the Internet Multicasting Service is provided by UUNET Technologies and MFS DataNet.